UK Wine Show, show number 7. Hi, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 7. This week we've got Ed McKenzie from Spy Valley. They're a winery in Marlborough, New Zealand, and they produce some pretty nice wines. He's going to be talking about sustainable viticulture. He's going to also talk a wee bit about Marlborough and how they make some of their wines. But before we get into that, let's have the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. It was game, set and snatch during the Wimbledon Tennis Championships when 300 crates of Champagne Lanson worth more than £90,000 were stolen. Thieves posing as contractors arrived in a lorry at the All England Tennis Club during the first week of the championships and collected the bottles, which sell at £50 each. The club had been informed that a collection would take place during a two-hour slot, and the thieves duly arrived, and having gone through the security procedures and provided the club with a receipt, took the champagne away. An hour later, the genuine contractors arrived to pick up the bubbly. In the Battle of the Brands, Hardy's has beaten off competition from Blossom Hill to be the top take-home wine in the UK. The Gallo family weren't too far behind, taking the third slot in our wine racks, according to the latest top 10 compiled by Nielsen and Checkout magazine. 9 of the top 10 brands were from the New World, Stowell's being the exception in 6th place. In Champagne, Meurthe and Chandon took pole position, followed in 2nd place by Veuve Clicquot. On the fortified front, Harvey's Bristol Cream secured the top spot, followed by Martini and Croft Original. And finally, winding down after work with a glass of red wine could set you up for a good night's sleep. Scientists in Italy say they've discovered that grapes used for making some red wines contain high levels of the sleep hormone melatonin. Melatonin is naturally secreted by the pineal gland in the brain, especially at night, and tells the body it's time to sleep. It was thought to be exclusively produced by mammals, but recently it was discovered in plants. Researchers at the University of Milan found high levels in the grape varieties Nebbiolo, Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon and Sangiovese. However, more research is needed to see whether the compounds are actually melatonin or just something similar. And that's all for the news this week. Over to you, Chris.
Thanks, Jane. Something you might want to consider, while some of the brands are huge in the UK, you may want to look beyond that. Fair enough, they are good value, particularly when you get a two-for-one deal. But in general, because of all the extra money they have to spend on marketing and raising brand awareness, they're often poor value. Have a look around. There's some awfully good wines. The main problem is these days is the supermarkets are really only stocking branded wines. So it is hard to find some of those really interesting wines when you're out doing your daily shop. But do have a look around. You will find some exceptionally good wines and possibly much better value as well. This week, we're going to be talking to Ant McKenzie. He's the winemaker at Spy Valley, and Ant's been in the wine scene for over 10 years now, making wines in Marlborough, and has done several vintages overseas. He's going to talk about sustainable viticulture, and he's also going to be talking a wee bit about Marlborough and what some of the differences are as you move around the Marlborough region. Some of those spicy gooseberry Sauvignon Blancs that are made aren't made in all of Marlborough, and it's good to know what is made where and how they're blending it. So let's have a listen to Ant. Okay, I'm here with Ant McKenzie from Spy Valley Wineries and based in Marlborough. How are you, Ant?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, we're actually in the London International Wine Show. It's a trade tasting for the trade, and Ant's been showing the Spy Valley wines off to everybody. Just quickly, how did you get into the winemaking, Ant?
Well, I'm from a winemaking region in New Zealand called Hawke's Bay. And as a kid, I used to look out at the vineyards, and I thought, well, that's a pretty cool thing to do. And also, I'm a bit of a generalist. I'm not really good at anything in particular, so winemaking affords you that luxury, a career where you don't have to be good at anything in particular.
Well, that's interesting, because New Zealand Cuisine rated you number 80 and the best Pinot Green maker in New Zealand. You can't be that much of a generalist.
Well, that says it all. I think Pinot Gris is a wine that is generally pretty interesting to most people. So I guess that's how I fit into that then.
It's a generalist wine.
Yeah.
Fair enough. How long have you been making wine, Ang?
Well, I've been in the industry about 15 years. I started at the end of 91. I've done heaps of vintages overseas, but I've actually been like a real winemaker for just under 10 years. Before that, I did vintages, dragged hoses. I was really a bit of a cellar hand, assistant winemaker, but calling the shots about 9 years.
Okay, and the sort of vintages, where have you been? California or...?
Yeah, I've been to California. I did one in Australia, a couple in northern Spain, which is pretty cool. And I've also visited other regions on sort of study tours, but not vintages. Been to Alsace.
I was talking to you earlier and you described yourself as a bit of a Riesling man. Is Alsace...
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of the more fuller-bodied style of Riesling. I think our region's particularly suited to producing that style. We do have a cool climate. It gives us just the right balance of acidity and ripeness to make fantastic fuller-bodied Riesling wines.
How would you describe yourself? If you were a wine, I know it's a bit of a tough question, but if you're a wine, how would you describe yourself as a wine?
Well, I think probably Riesling, to use the variety again, Riesling's a complicated beast. Often the most interesting thing about it isn't on the outside. You have to look into it a little bit further to really get to know it. Sometimes it can be austere. Sometimes it can be opulent and generous, so I guess that characterises me a little bit too.
Would you make yourself a German Riesling, a nice oily German Riesling, or more of a lean, limey style?
Yes, it's a bit of a chameleon, I guess. Probably more of a richer, generous style.
Just moving on to Marlborough itself. You're from Hawke's Bay, but how long have you been in Marlborough?
I shifted down to Marlborough, I think, 1995, and I worked for a winery there called Selax, and they built a winery, Selax Drylands Estate, and it's bought by Nobilo's a couple of years later, then bought by Constellation Wines. So I did that for a couple of years before getting my first real winemaking job with a small company called Framingham Wines, which did specialise in Riesling and probably produces one of New Zealand's best Rieslings.
And the Marlborough region... Most people sort of carve it up into two halves. You guys are on the Waihopai end, aren't you? What's the big style differences between, say, the Waihopai side and the Wairau? Can you just give a quick description of the two areas of Marlborough?
Well, I think the northern side, which is the side where the Wairau River flows, the soils are much more fertile, they're free-draining, the wines tend to be really full-on on the nose and often a little bit thinner on the palate. So the Waihopai side, which is on the southern side of Marlborough...
And that's where Spy Valley
is. That's
based.
Where Spy Valley is, correct, is more complex soils, more a little bit cooler, a little bit more elevation. And the wines are quite elegant on the nose, but they're very, very powerful and rich on the palate, which is probably more of a classical style wines than on the northern side, for sure.
So, just to give people an idea of the sort of difference, name a couple of producers on the Wairau side versus the Waihopai side.
Well, I guess the most obvious one is Cloudy Bay. I mean, although they get fruit from all over, they've definitely made a more pungent style of Sauvignon Blanc. But then you've got the likes of Hunters, Whitehaven, Wairau River Winery itself. Yep. They make, you know, pungent, upfront, fruit-forward wines, whereas wineries on the southern side, a little bit more elegance, more purity. You've got the likes of Witherhills, you've got the likes of Highfield, and of course Spy Valley.
I hear we note here that you guys are at 41 degrees 32 seconds south of the equator. How does that really equate in terms of the climate?
We're definitely a cool climate. If you looked at 41 north, I mean, it would put you in sort of, I guess, Bordeaux, Champagne, Alsace sort of territory. Although New Zealand does have like it's a sort of long, skinny country. You know, the latitude goes, I think, probably 5 or 6 degrees either way. So we're very much influenced by the ocean. That sort of moderates our temperature, so we don't ever get too hot. But on the flip side, we don't ever get too cold either. So it's a nice place to grow grapes.
So Spy Valley itself is on the Waihopai side. How long have they been growing grapes there now?
Well, the vineyards were established in the early 90s. We do have about 15 years of history on the site. When we started in the Waihopai Valley, we were the pathbreakers, if you like. So now there's vineyards and wineries all around us. So as a wine company, we started making wines under the Spy Valley label in 2000. So we've just completed our 7th vintage. Actually, this week, we picked a late harvest Riesling. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, you were saying that was botrytis earlier.
Yeah, like a botrytis style. So we leave it hanging out on the vines for a couple of weeks longer, and the botrytis grows on the bunches and concentrates the flavours, and we'll make that botrytis dessert style wine this year.
Is that common?
No, it's only the first one we've ever made. We tried to make one a few years ago, but we really didn't have the conditions. What you need is a little bit of temperature at the end of the growing season so that the botrytis can grow. And this season's been an early season, so I guess it finished a little bit earlier, and hence the season still had a little bit of heat left in it. So that's how that wine's evolved. So it'll be a very special and unique wine that we only expect to make every 3 or 4 years maybe.
What do you think the future holds for you guys? Have you been experimenting with anything, or you know, what in the next wee while, what do you think you'll be looking for?
We're just working towards refining more styles, going into the vineyard a little bit more and identifying parcels of vines that may contribute something a little bit special. And we're working on a vehicle to, you know, sell those wines, very, very small volumes. We'll be using those small volumes to push the window, I guess, with different winemaking techniques that may find a place in the, you know, Spy Valley wines.
And all your wines are single estates, aren't they? You don't have any contract growers or anything like that?
All of our aromatics, all of our Pinot Noir, Chardonnay are all off the home estate. What we started doing 2 years ago was buying in a little bit of northern side of the valley Sauvignon Blanc, so we're making more of a Marlborough regional Sauvignon Blanc now than an individual varietal single vineyard style. But for all of our other varieties, it's still estate-based production.
What are you trying to do with Sauvignon Blanc by bringing that in?
Well, we think there'll be some great synergies between the more aromatic, pungent characters on the northern side of the valley that will marry nicely with our very, very rich textural components off our vineyard site. And I think with Sauvignon Blanc, it's very, very important to have a style that exhibits both, because that's the key, that has been the key to the success of Marlborough Sauvignon Blancs. Whereas our single estate production with, well, particularly Pinot Noir has a history of being different every vintage, and that's part of the charm of the variety. Sauvignon Blanc, it really needs to be absolutely pure, focused balance of tropical texture, pungency every year.
In the vineyard, when we were talking earlier, you talked a wee bit about sustainable growing in New Zealand. Do you want to just give us an idea of what that means to Spy Valley and what it actually is?
Sure. Sustainable wine growing is an initiative started by the New Zealand Wine Institute a few years ago. And basically what set out to do is provide a guideline for how we can manage our vineyards in a sustainable way. So what they do is they approve various processes and, I guess, things that we can apply to our vineyards that look after the environment as well as it should be looked after, so that it's preserved for future generations. Within that, we've gone a step further, and we're looking at more, I guess, traditional techniques. Some people call them organic techniques to increase the potential of our vineyard site and preserve, continue making great wines for many years to come.
Are you moving towards organic, or are you trying to just take the best of breed?
Yeah, I mean, we're just looking at if there's a technique that's far better on the environment, we'll look at, but integrating that into our approach. And I think it's a holistic approach. We'll try and use the best techniques for each individual problem.
Do you want to give us an example of how you might do that?
Sure. Planting wildflowers down the rows of vineyards encourages lots of ladybirds. That has a beneficial effect not only on increasing the soil, fertility and complexity and structure, but also the ladybirds actually eat another competitor in our vineyards, mealybugs. So that's a good example of how a traditional technique is very beneficial.
Okay, and by eating the mealybugs, you don't have to spray as much. So
that's right. We don't have to use the insecticide to kill the mealybugs.
That saves you a bit of money, and also it helps the soils. We've got two wines to try here, so I thought we might crack into them. What we've got here, Ant?
We've got a white wine and a red wine. The white is the 2005 Spy Valley Riesling, and the red is the 2004 Spy Valley Pinot Noir.
And the 05's just been released, or is about to be released over in the UK?
We generally bottle the Riesling reasonably early. So this wine was bottled August, September last year. By the time it really hits the market, it's really only just before Christmas.
So that's a quick description of the wine for you, if you remember what it tastes like.
Of course I remember, it's my favourite wine of the vintage. It's a minerally, limey style of Riesling. It has a lovely apricot stone fruit note on the nose as well, which is a little bit different to what we normally have. On the palate, it's very, very rich and generous. It does have a smidgen of residual sugar, which balances, or acts as a foil against the natural acidity that's in Riesling.
I notice that richness. It seems a bit more richer than the 04, which I'm currently quaffing my way through.
Yes, well, I mean, that's the beauty of different vintages. And I think the 04 is definitely a more minerally limey style, whereas the fruit got a little bit riper in 05, and it's moved away from that sort of citrus spectrum more into a stone fruit spectrum. So yeah, it's a bigger, more opulent style Riesling than we typically produce. But hey, that's winemaking.
How'd the growing season go for the 05?
Well, the 05 was interesting because we had a poor flowering, and for those of you who are gardeners, I mean, the flowering is a really related to weather at a specific time of year. And for us, it's December. And the temperature needs to be mild, not too hot, not too wet, and not too windy. And we had quite a lot of, I think it was probably wind and cool temperatures at flowering the end of 2004, which of course was setting the potential of the crop for the 2005 vintage. So after that, it was just low crops. I think about 60% of the potential flowers were actually fertilised, which means that basically 40% less berries, so a lower crop.
What does that do to the quality of the wine?
Well, it concentrates the flavours, but it also means that the grapes ripen up quicker because there's less demand for, I guess, resources. So that they're available to a smaller number of grape berries, if you like.
So are you saying that like poor fruit set means you get less berries and more of the nutrients get concentrated into the berries, and that happens a wee bit faster than normally?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, a lower crop is the vine's response to saying, hey, we might be going into a season that is not quite conducive to ripening all the fruit that we'd otherwise set, so we will set less fruit and ripen it quicker.
Fair enough. The second wine I'm just about to get into is a 2004 Pinot Noir from Spy Valley. What do you say about this wine?
Well, this wine's great because it's very upfront. It's very obvious on the nose. There's lots of lovely charry, oak, coffee characters on the nose. There's also a nice sort of earthy note. One of the great things about Pinot Noir is the level of complexity that you can have. It's often earthy, smoky, charry, but underpinning that, there's also generous fruit. So it's very much a medium-bodied wine, has very, very soft tannins on the palate, and is generous. It's a thoroughly modern wine.
Would you say this is typical Marlborough, or maybe a bit of variation with the season?
Yeah, I think like Riesling, of the two varieties, I think Riesling's probably got the greatest potential of expressing the site in any one year. But Pinot Noir is second, and the reason it's second is because there's also a winemaker influence with Pinot Noir, whereas with Riesling it's more of it's probably 90% vineyard. I'd say Pinot Noir might be 70% vineyard, 30% winemaking. The human part of the terroir, what the French call terroir. So we've certainly worked on techniques to get the most out of the fruit from 2004, and to that end I thought increasing the complexity would be the best way of making the best wine in 2004.
You mentioned one of the taste on the tasting note, some toastiness coming through. How do you get that toastiness into the wine?
Well, it's from the barrels. We have a range of barrels from various cooperages in France that some of them contribute the very toasty coffee characters, and some of them just contribute, I guess, a nice vanilla, clovey, spice flavour to the wine. Another technique we do is a little bit of what's called barrel fermentation. So before the ferment's finished, some of the young fermenting wine gets drained into the barrels, and we drain it into those new toasty barrels, and that really accentuates that earthy, toasty note. So we decided to do quite a bit of that in 2004 and make that a feature of the wine. So, yeah, and I think we've been quite successful.
Just one last thing. What's your top tip for the people out there? Do you have a tip that will improve their consumption?
My tip to all wine drinkers is buy what you like. Don't get too caught up in the rubbish that's spoken about wine. It doesn't have to be expensive to be a fantastic wine. So trust your own taste buds and buy what you like.
Cheers very much. Thanks very much, Ant. That's brilliant.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ant. Next week, we're going to be talking to James Ellis from Ellis of Richmond. Ellis of Richmond is one of the oldest wine merchants in London. They started out selling directly to the public through a range of stores, but saw the writing on the wall in the 1970s when the supermarket started moving into the wine trade. They changed direction and now supply wine to the restaurant trade, and in the last couple of years have become an agency. That is, they import wines on behalf of the winery and really represent them doing the marketing in the UK. It's a really interesting story, and it's a really good history of how the UK wine scene has developed over the last 100 years. So until then, cheers and good drinking.